Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. Yeah, how it feels to be free. Well, some people aren't free. Some people are locked up forever. And that's something about what we're going to talk about today. If anybody has any comments, anybody hears this show has any comments about what you hear on the show, or you have an opinion about something or a question, you should get in touch with me. And I'm going to tell you to go to my website, and I think it's still working. Because I'm having a lot of trouble with my host. My host is telling me that I have hackers trying to get into my website, so they may have to shut it down. All of this is so far beyond me that it might as well be on Saturn. I mean, I just go with the flow if I can. But presuming you can get on my website, there's a place there, hopefully, where you can contact me. It'll say on the left, contact me, contact Mike or whatever. So it's faderfiles.com, FederFiles.com, faderfiles.com. And if that doesn't work, you can always just email me straight, just straight, no rocks. It's Mike Fader, MikeFeder, at nyc.rr.com. All right. This article, and it's a long one. I wish it wasn't so long, but I'll try to get through it. Appeared about a week ago in the on the front page of the New York Times, and it says the prosecutor who says Louisiana should kill more people. Yeah. Okay. Shreveport, Louisiana. This is by Campbell Robertson. A reporter is Campbell Robertson. In a much discussed dissent from the Supreme Court's ruling on lethal injection last week, Justice Stephen Breyer laid out the problems as he saw them with the death penalty. Among them was arbitrariness in application, including how simple geography can determine whether someone convicted of murder would be sentenced to death. Between 2004 and 2009, Justice Breyer wrote, just 29 counties, fewer than 1% of the counties in the country, accounted for approximately half of all death sentences imposed nationwide. Sorry about the coughing. we may get a cough button in here. The studios, I want to say that if you're a fan of PRN.FM, you would be amazed how fast everything is being done around here. I mean, I'm in one small studio. Soon a new bigger studio, which is the main studio, is going to be ready. And things are being installed. Every week I come in here, there's a whole bunch of new things. But one thing that I need probably more than other people, because my throat is messed up, is a cough button. And I'm presuming that we'll get one down the line. If you have a cough button just lying around your house, maybe in your kitchen, you could mail me one. I'll give you my address. Get in touch with me. I'll give you my address. You can mail it to me. All right. Meanwhile, you have to listen to my coughing. Okay. Caddo Parish, here in the northwestern corner of Louisiana, is one of these counties where many death sentences are imposed. Within Louisiana, where capital punishment has declined steeply, Caddo has become an outlier, accounting for fewer than 5% of the state's death sentences in the early 1980s, but nearly half over the last 5 years. Half of the whole state's death penalties, and there's more in Louisiana than in most states. One county. Even on a national level, Caddo stands apart. From 2010 to 2014, more people were sentenced to death per capita here than in any other county in the United States. Robert J. Smith, a law professor at the University of North Carolina, whose work was cited in Justice Breyer's dissent, said Caddo illustrated the geographic disparity of capital punishment. But this analysis did not go far enough. Caddo, he noted, has bucked the national trend in large part because of one man, Dale Cox. Mr. Cox, 67, who is the acting district attorney and who secured more than a third of Louisiana's death sentences over the last 5 years, has lately become one of the country's bluntest spokesmen for the death penalty. He has readily accepted invitations from reporters to explain whether he really meant what he said to the Shreveport Times in March, that capital punishment is primarily and rightly about revenge, and the state needs to kill more people. Yes, and he really meant it. And he has been willing to recount his personal transformation from an opponent of capital punishment, a belief grounded in his Catholic faith, to one of the most prolific seekers of the death penalty in the nation. He says, Mr. Cox says, retribution is a valid societal interest, he said in a recent afternoon, in a manner as calm and considered as the hypothetical he would propose was macabre. He said, this is him still talking, Mr. Cox. What kind of society would say that it's okay to kill babies and eat them, and in fact we can have parties where we kill them and eat them, and you're not going to forfeit your life for that? If you've gotten to that point, you're no longer a society. Mr. Cox later clarified that he had not seen any case involving cannibalism, though he described it as the next logical step, given what he, at several points, he called an increase in savagery. Mr. Cox's personal evolution not only serves as a window into the criminal justice system in Caddo Parish, Mr. Smith says, but also goes to the heart of the questions raised by Justice Breyer. Mr. Cox's personality has been under scrutiny here since he returned to being a prosecutor after 2 decades in insurance law. I guess insurance law isn't very exciting, but certainly what he's doing now is. Lawyers who knew him as a congenial and adroit trial lawyer said that in recent years he has become sullen and solitary. They have also described him as becoming increasingly aggressive in the courtroom, in some cases even threatening defense lawyers with criminal contempt for filing opposing motions. That's pretty serious, just for filing a motion. It's such a dramatic change, said Ross Owen, a former Caddo prosecutor and assistant United States attorney who now practices law in Shreveport. The behavior in and of itself might not be a big deal, he said, but given Mr. Cox's position and the fact that the defendants in most of these capital cases are poor and black in a part of the state with a deep history of racism, Mr. Owen added, Mr. Cox has got a loaded gun and he's pointing it at a lot of people. Mr. Cox, who rose from first assistant district attorney to acting district attorney after his boss died unexpectedly in April, did not dispute the work he does changed him and left him more withdrawn. He describes this as a natural result of exposure to so many heinous crimes, saying that the nature of the work is so serious that there'd be something wrong with you if it didn't change you. He went on to describe violent child abuse, murders, dismemberments in extended detail, pointing to a box on his desk that he said contained autopsy photographs of an infant who was beaten to death. He volunteered that he took medication for depression. The courts always say, evolving standards of decency tell us we can't do this or that, he said in an interview last week in his office, where he had been considering whether to seek death in one case and preparing to seek it in two others. My empirical experience tells me it's not evolving decently. We've become a jungle. The number of murders in Shreveport has decreased by more than 67% since the early 1990s, but Mr. Cox insisted that if the numbers were down, the nature of the crimes had become more depraved, and it demanded a different approach. Mr. Cox has refused to even entertain pleas of life without parole in homicide cases, for which he deemed death the only fitting remedy. In other cases, the office has prosecuted people for ancillary crimes even after they had made plea agreements. After a man was convicted in 2014 of smothering his infant son, a case that hinged almost entirely on differing interpretations of complicated forensic evidence, Mr. Cox wrote that the man, quote, deserves as much physical suffering as it is humanly possible to endure before he dies. Mr. Cox remains unapologetic, insisting that he believed what he was doing was right, but he was not entirely untroubled. I am humble enough and fearful enough, he said, considering the biblical commandment not to kill and his own place in the afterlife, that my God may say to me, I meant what I said, and you're out. So this is Mr. Dale Cox. Pretty extraordinary, pretty horrible, right? It caught my eye because, it sort of fascinated me because in my lifetime, I have changed back and forth in my ideas of capital punishment. And this isn't going to be a show necessarily about capital punishment, but I have changed a lot in my time. When I was in college and studied it for the first time really seriously, and then in my early 20s when I was thinking about it, and this is a time of Vietnam and the government itself was murdering people all over the – was murdering people in Vietnam, mass murder. It was killing people in inner cities. There was a lot of government perpetrated violence on other people, cruel, horrible violence perpetrated on other people, my own government. And I pretty much, like a lot of the people I knew, people who were opposed to the war and people who were working for civil rights, I mean, you know, you saw some of the things that that were done to people, civil rights workers and people who were marching for civil rights down south, and some of the things that happened in the inner cities. A lot of state-sponsored murder and aiding and abetting murder was going on. And I also I understood revenge. I always understood revenge because I was got a lot of neglect and a lot of abuse when I was a kid. And I always nurtured, that's one word for it, in my heart, a feeling of terrible revenge. I mean, I was really in a rage a lot, trying to get, you know, I wanted to get back at people. I didn't have the power to do it. And I didn't have something else that I think people need to do who actually practice, who can enact violent crimes. I sort of turned on myself, which better for society, you know, not so good for me. But I was an angry kid, and I just nurtured vengeance, retribution in myself. One day they'll all pay, kind of thing, right? For the stuff that was being done to me when I was a kid, And I had a lot of hatred in me and a lot of anger and retribution. I remember once I went to a shrink, one of the many that I've been to, and I asked him. He fired me. He was in process of firing me, terminating me, because I wasn't able to pay him, and I was so far behind in my payments. He wanted me to go away and go find somebody else. He couldn't keep doing it for free. And I said, okay, so give me some kind of capsule description of my worst problem when, so I can take that away with me. And he said, you have a cruel conscience, which I do. I have terrible judgments. I have all my life, or most of my life, I should say, been very critical and very judgmental of other people, harsh in a cold way, in an angry way. And it's that line of nursing that sort of judgment and criticism and vengeance on other people. Maybe I was born that way, but you know, I was brought up to feel that too. But in my early 20s, along with a lot of other people I knew, I was against capital punishment. I was firmly against it. It seemed to me that, you know, I was brought up in the 50s, and in the 50s, people, you know, were always talking about World War II. A lot of the guys had fought in World War II in my neighborhood. And then, of course, there was the evil empire that we were facing after the Nazis, after we, you know, killed enough Nazis so that they had to surrender, us and the British and the French, along with the Russians, that they finally just gave up. And then there was the Japanese that we were fighting, and they were, you know, they were hard to deal with, is putting it mildly, right? But once we were done with them, then it was, yet again, it was the evil empire. It was the Russians we were fighting, and then we were fighting in Korea. We were fighting the North Koreans. We were fighting the Chinese, and then there was always this horrible fear of nuclear annihilation, all of this stuff, right? But it seemed to me that that even throughout all this stuff, it seemed to me that the government did not, on top of everything else it was doing in the 60s in Vietnam, there was something illogical and something unethical and something just plain wrong with the idea of, and the reason I mentioned the war was because all these people were killed in combat out in the open. In other words, Americans, you know, we weren't the Japanese, and we weren't the Germans, and we weren't, as we found out later, the Russians, who were capable of rounding up prisoners of war or taking prisoners of war and torturing to death once they were helpless and locked up, or just outright killing them. The Russians did this, the Japanese and the and the Germans did this. But we did not do that. When we took prisoners of war, we just kept them cooped up and finally traded them back and gave them back to whoever they belonged to. But the idea, it occurred to me that the idea in my 20s when I studied it in college and when I read more about it, and, you know, there was always movies, you know, movies about mad dog gangsters that were executed in the hot seat, you know, in the electric chair. But there were also some thoughtful movies in the late 40s and in the 50s when I was growing up, and certainly in the 60s later. Even as far as the Nazis went, there was Judgment at Nuremberg, which even for the highest level, the highest ranking Nazis, people who had planned the mass murder of millions of people, you know, in war and just outright executions, they were being defended. And one of these things, one of the defenses was society should not take it upon itself officially to seek revenge on other people. Because what does that make people? What does that make people? In other words, we can't base law and civilization and society on cold-blooded, premeditated revenge. The state shouldn't be taking revenge on other people. Once they've been rendered helpless or once they've been judged guilty, put them away forever, yeah. But we don't kill people. And, of course, there's the religious argument. I didn't really feel that so much, but I had a touch of that, and I still do, that there's just something wrong with killing anything. That you kill one thing, you're killing everything. There's an old Jewish saying that says, to save one life is to save the whole world. Well, then, to kill one life is to kill the whole world. And I've always been careful about that, except when I was a kid. Like I said, when I was a kid, I was so angry all the time at the way I was treated. I did what a lot of kids do and people do when they're older. If they've been picked on and there was nothing they can do about it, they almost inevitably turn on something smaller and weaker and more helpless and pick on them. And in this case, in my backyard, there was all kinds of ants and insects and worms and bugs that I wreaked my vengeance on. But so I had a superego, a cruel conscience, and all of this combined to change my attitude about the death penalty. When I was in my early to mid-20s, after I had been, I thought I was a firm opponent of the death penalty, I joined the probation department. I became a probation officer, and I worked in Brooklyn Criminal Court, Brooklyn Family Court, and later in State Supreme Court of Manhattan, and every kind of crime, every kind of crime. We interviewed the people who had been convicted of crimes, and we sometimes interviewed the victims, too, of these crimes. And the crimes were ranged anywhere from, you know, possessing one joint to theft of a television, all the way up to, and I had many, many hundreds and hundreds of cases of interviews in jail, you know, jail holding pens and in state prisons and the Men's House of Detention in Brooklyn and in the Tombs in New York. You interviewed all these people, and the idea was that you'd recommend a sentence to the judge after you interviewed these people. The point of that was that the judge had such a caseload, such a huge caseload, that they had no idea really who they were sentencing. So in order to secure a little of real, actual mercy and justice, they asked a lot of people, probation officers like me, well, not enough people, but they asked people like me to do pre-sentencing reports. So I interviewed all these guys, and I interviewed people who had committed murder, who had committed rape, who had molested children in their own families, who had, in purse snatchings, had knocked down old ladies and killed some of them or ruined their lives because they were disabled afterwards. I interviewed people who had murdered other people in robberies and or had shot them and left them paralyzed. I interviewed a lot of men who had either cold-blooded, cold blood running through their veins and were just doing these things to other people or were just helpless and out of control, mindless, violent, or depraved people, you know, to use a word, to use a certain word. And it could really wear you out. It burned out a lot of people doing this kind of job, talking to these people. And what was even worse than that was interviewing the victims of their crimes. You know, I interviewed several women who had been raped, who had been violently raped. I interviewed, I had to talk to little kids sometimes, and women in families who had been raped by family members and molested by family members. I interviewed the survivors, you know, wives and husbands and family survivors of people who had been shot to death in robbery. So I was talking to the people who did it, and I was talking to the people who it had been done to. And what was much worse was talking to the victims of these crimes. Talk about a burnout job. It was really bad. And so I developed a hatred of this kind of violence. And my attitude towards capital punishment changed completely. I decided after working in the probation department, it seemed to me that that there were people that did not belong on this planet. Putting them away forever, even in solitary, wasn't enough punishment for them. In other words, I was feeling a lot like Mr. Cox, like Mr. Dale Cox, the prosecutor. I felt like I had been appointed the lone avenger, the official avenger of these people. My own sense of my own cruel conscience, by which I judged myself and everybody else was found wanting, my own feeling of violence towards other people to get even, the idea of retribution and vengeance, fused with the people who I talked to, the victims of these crimes, and I came at it as hating certain people, especially anytime there was an assault case of any kind, violence of any kind, I recommended the highest possible sentence. It wasn't up to me to recommend death sentences, but I recommended the highest possible sentence for anything that involved any kind of assault or rape or anything like that. And my attitude towards capital punishment was, yeah, pull the switch. I used to say, if you can't find somebody else to do it, I'll pull the switch. I'll give the injection. But you know, the truth is, I really didn't mean it. I could never have done that. I did believe that some of these people should be just eliminated from the world, and I felt that way for a long, long time.
Judge, Your Honor, hear my plea. Before you open up your court, I don't crave no sympathy for what I have to report. I caught up with a gambling jaw. I had warned her about once before. I pulled my knife and I went insane. The rest you already know. He said, Judge, Judge, good kind Judge, send me to the electric chair. He said, Judge. Judge, hear me, Judge, I want to get out of here. I want to take a joint to the devil down below. I sliced up my sweet patootie. I gotta read just what I saw. So, Judge, Judge, hear me, Judge, and send me to the electric chair. Listen to me, Judge. Please now send me to the electric chair. He said, Judge, Your Honor, Mister, Sir, I love that girl so dear. I don't want no bondsman, but go my bill. And I don't want to spend no 99 years stuck in your stinking jail. Judge, Judge, hear me, Judge, or send me to the electric chair. Cut her with my Barlow, and then I kind of kicked her in the side, and then I stood there laughing on her while she bubbled up in the. So Judge, Judge, yeah, but Judge, and send me to the electric chair. Come on.
Well, if that guy lived in Caddo County, Louisiana, he wouldn't even have to ask. They'd be sending him to the electric chair. And, you know, I know a lot of people have very differing opinions. Probably, you know, this is an audience that 95% or 90% feels very strongly against the capital punishment. But there's still a lot of people in this country who believe in capital punishment. All I can say is that since that time when I believed so fervently in it, and I kept that belief for a long time, what never went away was my feeling of vengeance. But whether or not that would even result if it was legal for me. Let's say the state said to people, we're not going to do this anymore. There's plenty of reasons we're not going to do it. I mean, actually, the DNA evidence did not exist when I was a kid, and there wasn't even any DNA evidence or forensic evidence when I was a probation officer in my early to late 20s. Didn't exist. It was always and still is a racist society, and a lot of people weren't paying any attention to the fact that so many more black people were being executed than whites, and none of this stuff that was pointed out by Justice Breyer was known by general public. There was no DNA evidence. But over the last, 30 or more years, close to 40 years now, with all the transformation stories, with all the stuff about DNA, the fact that we've learned that actually the death penalty doesn't stop anybody who is really going to murder somebody from murdering somebody. So there's no deterrent to the fact that there's a death penalty, there's capital punishment. The only people that the death penalty or the possibility of capital punishment stops from murdering other people are people who probably would never do it in the first place. People who would never come to that point in their lives would not be capable of it. And but I was thinking, you know, the last thing to go was the idea of vengeance, this idea of retribution and vengeance, and thinking yourself the sword of God, sort of like the way Mr. Cox does and the way I did for a long time and still do here and there. I have to confess to that. That's my confession in the court here. I used to think up until pretty recently, and I still have this little lingering spark inside me, that if somebody murdered, God forbid, somebody close to me, somebody in my family, that I would like the right personally to beat them to death or to shoot them to death. I wouldn't want the state to do it. I would feel better if I could wreak vengeance on them myself. This idea of vengeance and retribution is ancient. It's absolutely ancient. It's as old as organized groups of human beings. And it still hasn't gone away. In some countries, it's the law. It's still the law in some Middle Eastern countries. Vengeance is considered, I'm not going to say Old Testament, but, you know, an eye for an eye. Vengeance is considered in Saudi Arabia, for instance, not in Israel anymore. But vengeance in Saudi Arabia and a lot of fundamentalist or hardline Islamic countries, vengeance is considered perfectly legitimate, a foundation of society. You have the right to vengeance. Your family has the right to vengeance, and the state will do it for you, or the family is allowed to do it in a lot of Islamic countries. I don't feel that way anymore. If they caught finally in my old age, and why? If they caught the person that did something to somebody in my family, I would, and they tried them fairly, and they locked them up, and they put them away forever. That would be enough for me. I don't believe the state has a right, all things considered, DNA, transformation stories of people who have changed their lives and other people's lives after decades in prison. No matter how awful the crime, I don't believe that the state of Illinois, the state of New York, or the federal government has the right, whoever it is, and Mr. Dale Cox down there, has the right to take it upon themselves to kill people who are already locked up and already being punished. Maybe for some people, being locked up forever isn't punishment. Maybe that's all they were ever destined to be, and maybe they are comfortable with it comparatively. Maybe they don't miss a lot about what's on the outside. Some people need to be contained, and some people make a life in jail. Nevertheless, if you want to get rid of them forever, then that's what the jails are for. But they're not. What the jails are not for are all these minor drug offenses, especially anything involving marijuana and almost any kind of drug offense, unless it involves violence or mass criminal enterprises that result in the deaths of other people. Leave it go. How many people are in jail in the United States or in state prisons or in federal prisons because of drug offenses? And people are finally wising up to that. But what changed? What changed in me over all this time? One thing I have to say is that a sense of mortality. Now that I'm an old guy, and now that I'm, looking at the time to shuffle off the mortal coil, now that the big adios is not so far away as it once was when I was in my 20s and 30s, that changes. It just changed me. It softened me up. I mean, it hasn't made Mr. Cox, who's 67 years old, any different. It's made him harder, or it has not prevented him from getting tougher and more morose and more vengeful. We don't know this man's story. We don't know this man's story. The newspapers and other people have not written about why he has become sullen, morose, and more vengeful and more angry. But he's in a pretty bad position to be that way for other people. But I have to say that it was and is the idea of mortality. And also reviewing my, when I look back on my life, not that it's going to be over tomorrow, I hope, you know, but when I look back on my life now from this long distance from when I was born, I see all my flaws. I mean, not that I didn't always see them, but now I see them so clearly, more clearly than I ever did. And I have had many and still have many, many flaws, serious flaws. And I've hurt a lot of people. I don't mean physically, but, I've caused a lot of pain to a lot of people, most of it emotional pain. So I have flaws. Everybody's got flaws, right? All God's children got flaws. Recently, so it's that and the fact that I think now and I know now that I'm against the death penalty. My heart feels it. My heart feels it. It was at a year and a half ago that my heart almost ceased to work, practically blew up and almost split in half. So my heart I'm having trouble. We're doing signals about as much time as left. Is it about 20 minutes? All right, good. So my heart feels it. My heart feels it. And as I've gotten older, one thing for sure is as I've gotten older and, starting in my like 30s and 40s, and probably it was always this way. I was just acting crazy. And when I was a kid, I used to go around chopping down plants and cutting down plants. And my uncle used to, box me about the ears for doing that in his garden. Like I said, stomping on bugs, killing bees. I even had a BB gun, took pot shots at birds, and used to torture ants. I had a what was called a punk, a sort of a stick of incense that they sold in candy stores, and I would just torture ants. I mean, I was a crazy little sadistic kid, and it was... But it wasn't my nature. It wasn't my nature to be that way. I mean, given my actual real nature, what I really feel now is what I've really always felt is that I hate to break or kill. And I mean, even if I I won't even pull a leaf off a tree. So I'm not a Jane, J-A-I-N, but I don't even want to step on a bug. I don't want to be responsible because I feel this universal connectivity between everybody and everything. Everybody and everything. And I don't want to be the author of the pain or disability or death to any living thing or creature or person. But all of this. Off and on in my life I have meditated, done different kinds of meditation, mostly what's called mindfulness meditation, or Zen meditation, but basically sitting quietly and breathing. And recently I've gotten far more serious about it, far more serious than I had ever been. I had sort of been a dilettante about this off and on in my life, especially when I was lost and in trouble emotionally and existentially. I went to these places. You know, I tried, you know, going in. I have tried going to church a couple of times, see if I could go that way. I certainly went to my roots. I went into synagogues, various synagogues, and talked to rabbis about, tried to believe in God, about a bigger plan and a certain benevolence and a spirituality that controlled everything and was on the lookout for all of us. I could never bring myself to do it. I certainly couldn't bring myself to do the rituals. But when I came across, like a lot of people in my generation, when I came across Buddhism and meditation, and it wasn't just the meditation, but the idea of practicing compassion in the world, of feeling compassion and practicing compassion. Every religion teaches this. You know, they teach a lot of other things too, but most religions, and if you look at the major ones, at least on paper, Christianity, you know, Christ himself, taught compassion. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. I think people do love their neighbors as themselves. It's just that it's not always love. They feel towards their neighbors as they feel towards themselves. And I know that during my time on this planet, when I was feeling the most angry, it was really at myself that I was angry. When I was feeling the most hatred and petty, mean feelings towards other people, and unfortunately, I'm going through a period like that now, but I've had many periods like this where I was filled with anger and hatred. I remember when I was working at Sirius, first started working at Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm not on there right now, but this was about 9 years ago. I had a regular engineer, and I was always yelling about something. I spent almost the entire time I was on Sirius, up until about a year and a half ago, yelling about something. I mean, of course, I got a lot of listeners because that's what people like in talk radio. You know, look at Rush Limbaugh, and what's this guy named Savage? Is his name actually Savage? Mark Savage? I think that's his name, or something. And the people on talk radio, the ones who yell the most, who are the most violent and opinionated and loud, get the most listeners. They're obviously representing a kind of a mass societal anger and rage. There are so many people angry, and so many people who don't feel compassion. So people, in a way, do love their neighbors of themselves. And what I mean is that most people don't love their neighbors. Most people that I could see, or I should say a lot of people, I always exaggerate, a lot of people hate their neighbors. And really what it is they're hating their neighbors as themselves. So the only way I ever found out, the only way I could ever plug into some eternal flow, some constant, and I believe there is such a thing, a constant eternal flow of love and compassion in the universe. The only way I could plug into this, since I don't feel it too naturally, and that's too bad for me. I think a lot of people have been in my position where feeling love is anything from dangerous to almost impossible. Because when, you know, to hearken back to when if you're a child and you naturally, absolutely naturally, you love your parents or you just have a feeling of open-heartedness. I think of my kids and I think of how I was. I remember back when I was really, really little, there was a certain feeling of open-heartedness and trust. That's almost like a definition of an infant or a little child. Open-heartedness and trust. But if that is if that is refused, if that is turned back on you with violence or neglect or abuse, then you become the opposite. You become filled with distrust and with irritation and with anger and with feelings of vengeance. So how could a person possibly learn to love if they were never brought up, and never had their love rewarded to the point where they really understood what it meant to love other people and to have compassion for other people? I have had compassion for people when I was feeling good in my life. When I feel bad, I revert to a kind of default position of lack of compassion and irritation with everybody and some pretty nasty thoughts about other people. All of this is, again, loving my neighbor as myself. In other words, if you hate yourself, then you hate your neighbor. You love yourself, you love your neighbor. How do you think Donald Trump feels about his neighbors? Well, he makes it very clear. There's a lot of people he hates. Well, I was saying before, when I was at Sirius, I was always yelling and screaming, and there was always somebody I was angry at, or some group, or some person, and or some societal trend. And this has been going on and on and on in my life to the point where I'm tired of hearing about it as much as you are, if you've been a longtime listener of mine. And one time I remember we were off the air for a commercial at Sirius, and the engineer, who was this really sweet, mild-mannered kind of guy named Dave, we were taking a break for a minute for a commercial, and I was talking. I said, you know what I hate, Dave? And he said, you know, Mike, you hate a lot of things. that sobered me up somewhat, not enough to change me completely, but not, you know. And I've been running on that kind of vengeance and that kind of hatred and a kind of anger and desperation. I've been running on that like a kind of nasty fuel for most of my life. And it's never, ever done anything to me except corrode my insides and ruin my ability to really love other people. And as I said before, recently I've finally found a kind of meditation practice and group of people that I can meditate with. And this is almost sort of like a little congregation that I've joined. It's the closest thing that I can think of that I could deal with that of religion. Other religions, I never could quite figure out how to fit in. There was too much of a demand about a belief in God. There was too many odd rituals that I didn't want anything to do with. But at least twice a week, and I try to do it more, although the place where I go isn't so close to my house, there is this place called the Jewish Community Center on 76th Street in Amsterdam that has, in Manhattan, by the way. I know there are people listening in other parts of the country and the world. This is in Manhattan in New York City. They provide free mindfulness meditation, an hour every morning, Monday through Thursday, not on Fridays, of course, because it's also a synagogue, among other things. It's a Jewish cultural center, but it's also a synagogue. And on Friday mornings and Friday evenings, they don't have, preparation for the Sabbath, they don't have this. But every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, in the morning for an hour, and every 4 days a week, those 4 days, every evening for an hour, they have free meditation. There are places in the city where you have to pay to go to meditation. And that makes sense. I mean, you know, places have to pay their rent. They have teachers. They have supplies. They have electric bills. They have to pay for things. But this place, you know, brings in money from courses, and they have a permanent membership of a couple of thousand people. Some of them have a lot of money. So they just ask for contributions, but you don't have to pay for it. And I go there. It's a room, maybe I'm not good at distances, but maybe the room is 25 by, let's say, 18. It's a pretty large room. It's a rectangle, but it's a quiet room with track lighting that you can adjust to be low or high. Usually we keep it sort of middle or low. And it's a plank wooden floor, polished floor. And on it are fairly comfortable chairs. Not too comfortable because, you know, you want to sit there. And everybody sits in what they call a circle, but actually it's an oval because of the way the room is shaped. And there's a leader. There's a leader. There's a guide, somebody who has studied this for years, who has become what other cultures would call a master or a teacher or a guide. And they teach you mindfulness meditation, which is based, most of it, although there's this kind of a Jewish cast to some of it. Sometimes they relate it to Jewish, old Jewish wisdom or wisdom and compassion as taught in the Bible, the Old Testament. But it's very, it's also mostly Buddhist oriented. And the idea of compassion, the idea of compassion, that life, according to Buddha, was, you know, and there's no way I'm going to explain Buddhism to you because I only understand it very imperfectly. But the idea of compassion for other people, the idea of compassion for other people starts with yourself. When the teacher, when the guide is directing us, and when we go in there, we sit in this circle, and the teacher, whoever that is for the moment, whoever the guide or the leader of the sit, it's called, because we're all sitting down. Some people sit on the floor. Mostly women are able to do this better than men. They're more agile with their joints. And most of the other people sit in a circle. And it's more women than men, and it's in a slightly older group, although there's some young people. But it's mostly an older group, maybe, you know, I'd say the average age is 60-ish. And everybody sits, and then he talks about focusing on your breath and calming down, but focusing on your breath and being present in the here and now. And he talks also, or she, talks about compassion for other people and how it starts with yourself. And then you breathe silently. You focus on your breath and let your thoughts come and go, because the Buddhists say the mind is a monkey. The mind is a monkey. It jumps from one thing to another, and don't we all know that, right? Did you ever try to just sit still? Just sit still and be quiet and breathe in and out. It's the stuff that floods your mind is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, just a fireworks factory, an exploding, jumping fireworks factory of thoughts and feelings and emotions. And the idea with this meditation is to slow that down and to feel a certain kind of detachment from it so that you don't feel like you're at the mercy of these things, that they run you rather than you are including them. And the whole idea of this mindfulness meditation and the Buddhism that it's teaching is that you don't battle, you don't fight with your demons and your, you know, your scary thoughts and your scary feelings. You don't fight with your demons. You know, the old idea of, you know, encountering, you know, shamans and other people in certain traditions. You go down into the underworld and you fight with the devil or with the demons or the evil creatures or the spirits, and then you triumph over them. And usually it's got to be a shaman or somebody like that. You triumph over them, and you and then you come back up to the surface. You come back up to the surface. The idea in this Buddhist mindfulness meditation is to not to triumph over it, but to first become aware of it all, how unaware I've always been and how unaware most of us can be in our lives of the forces that are running us and the reactivity. Most of what we do seems like, or we may fool ourselves into thinking that we choose to do this and that this is something that we're doing, but mostly what we're doing is reacting to things that happened to us a long time ago and that we have set fixed patterns on how to react to them. And our fears, our angers, all the anger I've always had all my life, all the fears I've always had all my life, these are reactivity. They're reactions to things. And the whole idea of sitting there in this mindfulness and this calmness is not to react automatically, not to react automatically to absolutely everything and everybody and every stimulus and every internal thought or every fear or anger that pops up in you or every feeling of whatever. It could even be, you know, other feelings, lust, joy, anything that pops up in you. The idea of this meditation is to just notice it and to keep breathing so that you finally not triumph over things that are troubling you or not triumph over your mind or your heart or your body, you know, not to will it into being the way you want it to be, but to first become aware of it and then to accept it with compassion. There are people who have compared this practice to a perfect kind of mothering. If you didn't get any mothering or bad mothering when you were a kid, and this is essential to developing a sense of self-regard and compassion. If you didn't get this when you were a kid, and how many of us have gotten a perfect dose of it? A lot of people have gotten something very far from that, and the lucky ones have gotten a perfect dose of it, and if there is such a thing. But can you, the idea that this is almost like to mother yourself, to have mercy and compassion first on yourself. You cannot have it for other people unless you have it for yourself. Cannot have it for other people. Is such a thing possible? Can you provide the mothering that you're supposed to get when you're an infant or a toddler, which is completely formative of your self-regard and your feeling towards other people and your ability to have compassion for yourself and other people? Can you replace that at all? I don't know. But this is what Buddha came up with, and this is what the mindfulness meditation is all about. And at this late stage, near the end of the game, this is what I'm trying to do, because that's what I need to do, is find compassion for myself so that I will have compassion for other people. And maybe out of this kind of soil, love can grow. As for Mr. Cox down in Louisiana, I don't know what's gnawing in him. I don't know what's driving him crazy, but he is swimming in a vat of his own acid. He is destroying himself. The sword he is using to cut off other people's heads is cutting off his own head. What's bothering this man, we don't really know. We don't really know. But we can only try to forgive him and have compassion for him and see what comes of that. It's hard to have a heart in this world, to be a human being with a heart in this world. But it's absolutely necessary to try.
For the life of me, remember a Saturday. I know they say let it be, but it just don't work out that way. And the course of a lifetime runs over and over again. No, I would not give you false hope on this strange and mournful day, but the mother and child reunion is only a motion away. Oh, little daughter of mine, I just can't believe it's so. Though it seems strange to say, I've never been late so low. Such a mysterious way, and the course of a lifetime runs over and over again. But I would not give you false hopes on this strange